Podcasts from around the world.
Hello and welcome to our latest podcast. Today I am joined by Oliver Drews. Hello, Oliver.
Hello, Michael. Good to meet you.
Who is one of the European members of our geopolitical task force at Weber. And today we're going to talk about Ukraine and Russia and the geopolitical impact that may have and has already had, particularly across EMEA, but also the world. It's important to say that we're recording this on Monday, the 14th of March. Things are moving and changing so quickly that when this goes out, some of the aspects may have changed. So just before we begin, Oliver, just tell us a little bit about the Weber Task Force and what you've been doing.
Well, the Geopolitical Task Force consists of geopolitical experts across the globe. And as we're meeting regularly, we very quickly understand what the implication of certain policy developments or certain decisions of or certain stances of different continents or governments means for, let's say, a global cooperation. Because when country X says the one thing and country Y the other, how to choose, how to navigate between these two choices. And this is increasingly important as we see that, let's say, the independent, also even from a European point of view, where the Europeans are now striving for independence or geopolitical independence or autonomy in their decision making, corporations can less and less rely on, let's say, global rules, which mean the same thing for everybody. And that is an increased sense of risk and need to understand how to act in different places of the world simultaneously to stay afloat and be successful.
So, and you've got particular interest. You served on the European Commission on their task force.
I did work for many years for the European institutions, including the European Parliament and the European Commission. And there have been dealing with the relations between the European Commission, the United States, Asia, and Russia. I've been engaged in many bilateral agreements and negotiations also with Russia in particular. So I developed a little bit of an expertise and also knowledge of these type of topics, as well as the players around the table.
Amazing. So thank you for your time and input into this. I think it's going to be really interesting to get a point of view and to hopefully have a bit of a deeper understanding of where we're at. So as I said earlier on, it's Monday the 14th of March and we're on day 19. And there are lots of different words to use what's been happening, everything from crisis, war, incursion, invasion, or maneuvers. I don't think anyone, I suppose, thought it would necessarily go on this long, if, you know, if at all. But it looks like Putin is kind of cornered and therefore more dangerous. And in fact, today I was seeing on the news that that Moscow have reached out to Beijing for some financial aid and some possible weaponry aid, although that hasn't been, I think that Beijing is saying that actually hasn't happened. But regardless, Putin is kind of backed into a corner. Is there a win-win scenario where Putin can kind of win and save face in the eyes of Russia, but there can be a peaceful retreat out of Ukraine? Or is there only one way this can go? Bearing in mind that for Putin and Russia, it is a, you know, a save face. He's gone into Ukraine. He's got to show his people that he is going to win, in inverted commas.
Well, Michael, I think the most honest and simple answer to this is that we have to say nobody knows. But as we are already now in day 19, as you say, and the embezzlement and surprise and shock around the world about this has a little bit evaporated in the sense that we now all understand that this is going to be taking a very, very long time. The difference between day 19 and, let's say, day 2 is that I think when you speak to some different experts on the matter, also from a different, let's use the word geopolitical point of view, it kind of strikes me that what people say is that there is one very clear outcome, and that, as I spoke to actually a diplomat on the thing this morning, and he said, look, whatever is going to happen, one thing is clear. By the end of 22, Russia will cease to exist as it is now. The only question is, how much collateral damage are we going to have along that way? until it is going to be the end of 2022. And when we see at recent developments and really kind of things which happened really, really recently, I think one of the interesting things is that it seems that those Secret Service elements in the Russian system who were supposed to advise Putin on how this goes, how the mood in the Ukraine is, how fast this will go, that they have been arrested in Russia because they gave the wrong advice. It seems, and this has been reported in many newspapers, that they told Putin that this will go very fast, that the Ukrainians would be very happy when he marches in, and that everything will be fine ever after again. And that actually all the Western nations would kind of say, well, okay, this happens, but let's move on. There seems to be a deep miscalculation here. Another element is also that when you consider that Ukrainians and Russians are very close, also from the history point of view, that he is now bombing Kharkiv and other places where actually those people are living who are supposed to applaud his arrival, then we see that there is no easy solution. There is not going to be an appeasement very soon. This is going to take very, very long. And coming to your point of China, I think this has been reported earlier on. I think there have also been reports that along the Olympic Games, it was said that Putin and the Chinese made some agreement. And also some reports coming out of the FAO and particularly being spread out in Italian news is that the Chinese agriculture main organization buying food and food supply started last summer to build up their stocks. And this is by some observers also something one should read certain conclusions out of.
There's many things in there. So one, the fact that this is obviously something of this scale must have taken, you know, months, years to plan. So the miscalculation by the people around Putin, the Special Secret Service, or whoever, you know, his advisors are, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary, the size of that miscalculation, in that what they thought, it hasn't been a quick incursion at all. You know, we're on day 19. And actually the voices of Western democracies and countries, you know, have been deafening in their negativity around Russia. Just picking up, and we'll come back to that in a minute, but I just wanted to pick up on something. So you said that the diplomat said to you that by the end of 2022, whatever happens, Russia will look very, very different, the shape of Russia. Now, I'm assuming, because that could either be, it'll be much bigger, it'll be smaller, it'll, I'm sure, undoubtedly be isolated in any way. But what sense do you get from that comment then from the diplomat of the shape of Russia? Is it just because it is just going to look different, or do you think there's a...
They say that it's going to be economically completely broken down. It will then need to rely on China to stay afloat. And on top of that, an important element to mention, Michael, is that when you go to recent polls, for example, what the Atlantic Council has published, I think, 2 or 3 days ago, 71% of the Russian population do support Putin. That's what's happening at this stage. The reasons for that are manifold, but that's what we're having at this stage. And still now on day 19, this seems to be the case. And that's also an important factor in the whole development, which shouldn't be ignored.
So we just mentioned there that the voices of condemnation of Russia from around the world is deafening. But there have notably been those that haven't fully condemned Russia. So China being one, but also India, Iran, Pakistan. Is this kind of a new axis of power that we're seeing? So from a geopolitical shift globally, are we seeing, you know, really now a new axis? I think South Africa as well is one that hadn't fully condemned either.
Well, I would be very reluctant to use that word. And I think, or that description, I think one should also look at to kind of why are they having a different point of view? Is that out of considered strategic considerations, or is that out of caution? I think we must also see that in many regions, Russia did play a certain role, and that in some certain regions, there are different power games and power plays and balance of power in which Russia played, for some of these countries, a certain role. And that shouldn't be forgotten. That's very important. That plays into it. But I think there was also a clear sign from the United Nations where really, and that's what you're referring to, where really most countries of the world condemned it. And I think that was also an element which was noted by these countries you just mentioned. And I think that also plays into it. I think, again, that here we must say it's everything is really open. The positions might shift. I think the Western reaction was also completely unexpected by many, seeing recent developments in other geopolitical considerations. And that is something which is new. When we compare to 2014, for example, where the famous former Czech foreign minister, who used to be the first advisor of Václav Havel at the time, said, this started in 2014, he said. In 2014, the rule of law didn't anymore apply to how nations are being placed or present on the European landscape. So what started in 2014 is now unfolding. And he then said this will have an unprecedented consequences for how Europe is going to be organized. And I think we're now really in a big way in the middle of it.
Yeah. So specifically, just looking at some of the EU countries and the way they've responded. So, for example, Germany is now announced that it's investing more in its defence than it ever has done before. And it's also readjusting its strategic energy mix. And Switzerland taking sides and condemning Russia. You know, Switzerland have always, you know, have never really taken sides. So that's a massive, massive change. But how are these going to impact their political futures and also the knock-on effects across Europe? And not just Europe, but also the role of NATO, and then ultimately with that, the US as well.
Well, I think, first of all, we can somehow say that in Europe, multilateralism is back. We remember that some prominent politicians, like, for example, even Macron said that NATO is brain dead a couple of years ago. He would never say that again at this stage, for sure. So we see that multilateralism is back. I think Europeans clearly understood now to the last person that you just can't rely on external factors taking care of your safety and security and future destination, that you need to play an active role in that. And that became, I think, very adamant, very clear. And that, in my view, is going to lead to a total policy shift and reorientation of, I think, really all European nations. They're all going to look differently as to kind of, where are we? What are we going to do? And we will have very tough decisions to make here, and it will have a huge impact. So I think within, even if, like you see, the smart people said, like I told you so in November, and there were these reports from the US Secret Service out already in October, this is going to happen. I think nobody in Europe really believed it, including Ukrainian observers. I just spoke to a Ukrainian 3 days ago, who is an advisor in the government, said, like, well, we saw all the troops. We kind of calculated that this is something which, of course, on a chessboard, so to speak, can happen, but we never believed that it really would be like that. And therefore, it really brought a total change in the mindset, I think, of even the last European, a total reshift of kind of left, right, middle. And the consequences of that, it's day 19. But again, here it's clear there is going to be a total shift, could be in all kind of directions. At this stage, it seems to be standing together and trying to have an answer to this.
And it's incredible to think that we've just come through a couple of years and still in COVID and a global pandemic, but seem to have got through the worst of that, which one quite rightly would have thought that has changed the world forever. But actually, this feels like, in terms of our political futures, this is really much more of a turning point than actually kind of the impact of COVID.
I totally agree with you, Michael, there, because COVID, if you translate it, for example, to the European debate, COVID was, for example, good for German digitalization, because Germany was running 15 or 20 years behind in digitalization. And COVID kind of, you know, you could explain all kind of positive effects of that in terms of getting business organized, etc. But that was all happening within, let's say, the system, so to speak. This situation is going to, as many observers say, from left to right, up and down, this might be a pivotal moment for total change, which we haven't seen yet how it will evolve. But this is really a, sadly enough, very historic moment for Europe, for sure.
As I sit in London, and I have to ask, just the impact of Brexit on the UK, because coming out of the EU a couple of years ago with Brexit, do you think that it's really weakened the UK's defences and also the UK's influence as well? And although still a member of NATO, is it more isolated and ignored than ever?
I think that it greatly negatively impacted the UK in that sense. But at the same time, I should say, it negatively impacted also the European Union. Why is that? Well, first of all, from a geopolitical point of view, we know that it was always a strong agenda point of Putin to get the UK out of the EU, as his plan was always to kind of, if you divide the nations, if you don't acknowledge, let's say, the international institutions, because you are kind of a person of power and of the nation state and of forces and of army and this kind of stuff, then it could be his plan to get the UK out. Now, there are all kind of conspiracy theories, right or wrong, I think brought up by The Guardian and also The New York Times has a very elaborate series on it, which was then done by James Cantor, a very renowned journalist. So people can go into that and look into that. I don't want to go into that speculations because that's the past. But also when we look at the European Union, and I've seen it myself, I've been at hundreds of European councils where the UK always had a very kind of Atlantic international competition point of view on how to organize societies. I think the fact that UK is not anymore into the mix of policy debates on whatever issues is having a very specific effect, which we saw at the European Council now in Versailles, where really French-led kind of, you know, only Europe approach or kind of a very state-led approach on reality is taking shape, where some observers say that this is not good for transatlantic relations in terms of business and competition and innovation. And whatever people say or like about it, but it's clear that that UK voice is missing. So it's, and that's as bad for the European Union as for the UK. But I think we clearly see that in all kind of debates and things, the UK is not any more present. And then through the back door, one shouldn't forget that on many concrete policy issues, the UK would then either need to adapt to, let's say, the US system or the EU system, as Switzerland is doing. You know, you can't on your own as a small nation define global rules and standards. So you need to adapt to the one and the other. And I think the UK was one of the big shapers of rules in the past because they had the best civil servants and companies and ideas coming in. And now they have to reluctantly, in many cases, just adopt what Brussels or Washington or whatever policy of choice is dumping on them. So I think that is technically correct what I say. So this debate, we see now that the UK is trying to realign. We see the British ministers coming to Brussels, and now we see all this kind of unity and standing together. I think that the UK foreign minister was even invited to the ministerial meeting, though not having an official seat here. But I think as an example, it's a great example because we see this geopolitical breakdown of systems, of nation states, of global rules shifting towards kind of the rules of brutal power, which we are seeing now unfolding, that Brexit could be seen as one element in that long chain, which is now unfolding before our eyes.
So, Oliver, the growing refugee crisis in continental Europe, it's growing day by day, and it, you know, it's not going to end anytime soon. Many countries have opened up their borders, but there is reporting of selective entry into some countries too. Immigration has always been such a hot button across Europe. So how is this crisis going to alter that political landscape in Europe? Are we going to see more of the rise of the right, the rise of the left? Like, why is this now different from others?
Well, Michael, I perfectly understand what you're referring to, and this is a very interesting question because a few things are very clear in this debate currently. First of all, this is a different refugee crisis than in 2015 because this time there are much more really women and children coming in from a direct neighboring country where people in, let's say, Poland and other neighboring countries see them as their direct, as they say it, family or brothers. And not only that, they see these people as the first line in defense for their own cause. So these people are being brought in as heroes, so to speak, and they're spread around Europe. Also, the response of the European Union in its totality was that these people are getting immediately a residence permit and a work permit. So they're not having that refugee status as such, which is a clear different approach. And there's an overwhelming support for bringing in refugees in an unprecedented fashion. And I think that is really what is happening now. Of course, when we look at the numbers, and when we have to acknowledge that, even if that's hard to say at this stage, but probably most of them will not be able to go back, at least not very soon. And when you see kind of politicians in Germany, in France, in Scandinavia making estimates kind of, well, 2 million already, might be 5 million. Who knows really how much people are coming over? It could be much, much more than that. So one thing is sure, it's going to be the largest wave of refugees since the Second World War. And that will, of course, have its price and its strain. And that's going to take much longer than day 19, where we're in today. So how this is going to be looked at in, let's say, day 100, which we're certainly going to see, that is hard to predict. But we must not forget there's a big difference in terms of the refugee crisis in 2015, for all the good or the bad reasons. But that's what we're really in, and that's how it is unfolding now.
So, Oliver, we know, and we know it from the media, but we also know it from our own people as well, is that different regions around the world are engaging or seeing what's happening in Europe in different ways. But undoubtedly, this is a moment in time. But arguably, and again, it's been reported, actually, what we're going to see over time is the economic shift. So the global economic impact, which will come in time, that's going to have a massive difference. And we can see that from some of us who are working with clients on this, is they are calculating now how kind of the shift in the map and the shift in kind of the landscape is going to affect them over the longer time.
Yeah, I think that is also a key point, because it shows that this issue is having a global impact. You cannot say that it's only relating to Europe, because if you, for example, see that Russia is in certain regions a power player, whatever happens in these regions, this power player as a factor is going to disappear. And that is also strongly related to the enormous economical weakening of Russia, which is happening, and which is not coming back. We also, therefore, in economic terms, see that this has a global effect on how the economic power play is being organized. And if we see at the sanctions, which is being imposed by almost, apart from governments, but by many, many global companies from countries around the globe, then we see that these sanctions have a direct and very severe impact. And it's only not only in the sense of kind of close this sector down or close that chain down or close the outlets down of that kind of brand. But when you close the brand, and even if you could replace it with your own brand, your own production or your own food chain, the people are gone and the exchange between people is gone. One observer recently said in his famous Swiss newspaper that this kind of not having access to workforce from abroad, not having the exchange between workforces in other countries, will immediately lead to a lack, a total lack of innovation and future-orientedness of the Russian economy. And as they were already very much concentrated on things which maybe other nations wouldn't kind of say this is innovation in a digital area or comparable areas, very much relying on fossil fuel exports, etc., observers say that this is really have an effect, an immediate effect in terms of closing down, but also a long-term effect of making the country uninnovative. And that will mean that it's going to be a really small player for many years to come, unless something changes quickly.
Oliver, thank you so much for joining me today. As we said, it's day 19. This, unfortunately, is probably going to go on for some time, so we will continue to chat and feed through information to all of the markets. As Oliver said at the beginning, the task force, the Weber Shandwick Task Force, is doing that and looking this on a daily basis. Also, please remember that we will be matching employee donations to the UNHCR, Save the Children and World Central Kitchen up to a value of $10,000. And if you want to participate, you can use the form that came along with this email. Also, if you've got any questions at all, or if you need support, then please do get in touch with your talent team and we'll do our best to help you. Remember, talking to each other, asking each other how you are is all important in what can really feel like quite a helpless time. So again, thank you, Oliver, for joining me, and thank you all for listening.
Podcasts from around the world.